are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, radio that explores the power of active nonviolence through conversations with activists in the field, as well as scholars and artists and anybody out there who's trying to explain with their life and their story the way that nonviolence works. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm usually here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler, also my news anchor, who is not joining me today, but I'm going to tell you about what we have planned for the show. First of all, we're going to be talking with Sumbul Ali Karamali, and she's the author of a book called The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, which is the bronze medal winner of the 2009 Independent Publishers Awards, and also Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam. And I think we can understand why this interview is taking place today because of all of the anti-Muslim rhetoric that led to putting somebody in office. So we're going to be talking a lot about that today on the show. And then for our news portion of the show, although all of this is a form of news, I'll be talking with Shannon Radsky of the Nonviolent Peace Force and the work of unarmed civilian peacekeeping, as that they actually just were in North Dakota. So we're going to be talking, getting an update a bit from the field there and with the group that's doing work on the ground all over the world and has just done the first set of work in the United States. So let's turn now to our guest, Sumbul Ali Karamali. Welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you because I really enjoyed the conversation that we had before the show, and I think that it's going to be a rich discussion for our listeners today. You're the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, as well as Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam. And you have a website, the muslimnextdoor.com. So I'm guessing that you practice Islam, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your personal experiences with the religion and how you came to the work of trying to explain to a general audience who's unfamiliar with the practices of Islam what it means to you and to put a human face on a religion that's very dear and very precious.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. In a way, my whole life was kind of getting ready to write my book. And it's because, you know, I grew up in Southern California and I was the only Muslim that most people around me knew. So I was the first Muslim that my teachers had come across. I was the first Muslim, or I was the only Muslim that most of my friends had come across or knew. And so I ended up answering a lot of questions. As you know, Stephanie, if you're the only one around, then you get all the questions, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in elementary school, it didn't matter that much because we don't talk about religion on the playground. And it only came up if I, say, went to a birthday party and I couldn't eat pepperoni pizza because pepperoni was pork and I had to explain to them that I couldn't eat pork because I was Muslim. And that kind of opened up a discussion. But for the most part, it really didn't interfere in my daily life. You know, I think kids who grow up in faith, we're all sort of taught the same things. We're taught not to lie and not to cheat, not to steal, be respectful to our parents. In my case, you know, being Muslim, it was also how to pray and how to fast during the month of Ramadan. And then when I went to Stanford for college, that was really the first time that I felt like I was in an interfaith 101 situation, because I was living in the dorm and everybody in the dorm knows each other and what they're doing. And again, I ended up answering a lot of questions, and which continued. I went to law school, started practicing as a corporate lawyer, and I would get these questions that just kind of stunned me. Like for the first time, I had a partner sit down and say, you know, why are Muslims more violent than other kinds of people? And, you know, there I was. I was 25 years old in my new suit looking nonviolent. And it was just kind of a shock to me. And people also started asking me for recommendations for books on Islam. And at the time, there really wasn't anything. So I thought, well, I'll write one. So when my husband's job took us to London, I did a graduate degree in Islamic law. This is after I got my JD, and then I came home and wrote my book. And I wanted it to be, I really wanted to answer the questions that people have asked me all my life. You know, I didn't want to write a textbook. I didn't want to write a boring book on Islamic history. I just wanted to answer the questions that people ask me.
Well, I think it seems like that takes a lot of maturity and to be able to do, because when you're being asked questions like, why are Muslims so violent, I could imagine feeling a bit of being the only one as you're growing up. That's not your job to explain to people either. Just because you practice Islam, that's not your job. And so to be asked these questions and to have a sense of curiosity about where their question is coming from and why. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how you begin to answer questions that you might find tedious?
Yes. Well, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't learn about world religions. So now I've met a lot of teachers, and they came up to me when I was doing my book tour, and they said, you know, we have to teach world religions in seventh grade, and we don't really have anything age appropriate on Islam. So could you write something? And that's why I wrote my second book. But so now they do have to teach world religion. In my day, they didn't have to. And so people had not the slightest idea. And I guess I kind of took it in stride. You know, I started answering questions from a young age, and you know, trying to explain to people. I know it sounds weird to you, you know, like to my friends when I was in high school and fasting during Ramadan, they couldn't understand it. Like, why would you do that? And I'd say, well, you know, I know it sounds weird, but it's not so different from people who fast during Lent, or, you know, people who fast during Yom Kippur. We're all trying to, you know, get over our, you know, bodily urges and trying to be more spiritual and think about higher things and think about what it means for people who don't have access to food and water. And so sometimes, you know, I would get into these conversations, and I guess I never thought of it as not being my job. I felt like I just kind of took it in stride, because it was, you know, we all have to connect with each other. In America, we have so many diverse traditions and cultures and backgrounds. And if we don't connect with each other, then how will we survive as a country and as a world? You know, the world is just getting smaller. And I think the only choice is to have more cross-cultural understanding. And so for me, I felt like it was not only incumbent on me, but incumbent on everyone to try to answer questions if people were interested enough to ask them. It was hard when people were venting. I mean, the person who said, why are Muslims more violent than other kinds of people? I mean, she really didn't want to hear my answer. She just wanted to vent her feelings. And so that's different. That is difficult to deal with. But, you know, there are lots of people who are genuinely curious. And I feel like it's an honor to try to explain to them.
That's amazing. For those of you just tuning in, I'm talking with Sambal Ali Karmali, who's the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, as well as Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam. And we're talking a bit about some of these Islam 101 questions that she gets on a regular basis and throughout her life as she's been going along the path of explaining her faith to others, but in a way that is extremely helpful for very tedious questions, such as why are Muslims so violent, a question that at a time almost doesn't necessarily deserve a response. Or something that I heard recently was that, well, Muslims use their religion to justify violence. And I was thinking when I heard that, I said, you know, who doesn't justify violence in this culture with something or other? And so to project that onto Muslims felt to me extremely hypocritical. And so I really am grateful for the work that you're doing, because I just don't feel like I'm in a place to be able to
thank you
to do that.
Well, you know, it's funny, when I was writing my book, of all things, I found that I kept remembering Star Trek episodes. Stephanie, I don't know if you're at all a Star Trek fan.
Well, I'm a fan of people, so tell me about it.
Well, you know, my very first crush was Captain Kirk.
Oh.
When I watched, you know, I grew up watching Star Trek reruns, and and then when I was in law school, they showed Star Trek reruns right about the time I was sitting down to eat dinner. So I ended up watching a lot of episodes. And when I was writing this book on Islam, I was amazed at how many episodes kind of popped into my brain. And one of them has to do with what you were just saying. So many people say, oh, religions are responsible for so much violence in the world. But there was this Star Trek episode where there were two, and your listeners might know this, but there were Captain Kirk runs into two aliens, and they are at each other's throats, and they want to kill each other. And half their face is black, and half their face is white. Hmm. And Captain Kirk says, well, why do you hate each other? Why do you want to kill each other? And one of them says, can't you see what he looks like? Hmm. And Captain Kirk says, well, he's half black, half white. And the alien says, no, he's black on the right side, and I'm black on the left side.
Hmm. Okay.
And so, you know, and so, yeah. So I just thought, you know, we don't need a reason to start fighting. Right. If there's no reason to start fighting, we'll come up with one. Mm-hmm. This is what human history has taught us, that we have to kind of wake up and say, you know, we're not going to give in to some of those urges, which is actually another Star Trek episode.
Okay.
Cool. But, you know, I think the fighting or the warfare comes first, and then the justification comes after that. And it doesn't matter if it's territorial justification or a human rights justification or a religious justification. I mean, we will always find something.
Mm-hmm. So we will definitely have to have you back to have a Star Trek episode of our radio program, because it seems like there's a lot of insight there. But let's really turn back to the story of Islam, though, and what are some of the other questions that come up for you besides, why is Islam violent, for example? And let's talk about that as well. Let's get to that. I don't want to just throw that question out there and then let it hang in the air of the radio waves, you know, going around. So, but what are some of the other questions?
Yeah. So I think the two main questions that I get have to do with violence on the one hand, and that is definitely because of our public discourse. You know, I just read a study where they showed that 9 out of 10 media reports on Muslims are in the context of violence. So 90% of what everyone hears in this country is Muslims conflated with violence. So, of course, people are going to have that impression, whereas, you know, when we hear of Buddhism, for example, we don't hear about it in the context of violence, even though there are conflicts in the world involving Buddhists.
Right, the Rohingya, so, for example.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, I think that's the problem, is against this media backdrop of all these media reports that have to do with violence. I mean, Muslims are never on the media, not in the context of violence, even though there are so many things happening out there that involve Muslims. So that is on the one hand, that's a really common question. The other one that I get all the time is about women. And you know, when I was working in the law firm as a corporate attorney, one of the partners said, "Well, of course Islam is sexist. You don't think Islam is sexist?" And you know, there I was, a woman corporate lawyer who was Muslim, and yet he's saying, "You don't think Islam is sexist?" And so it's really funny because growing up, my dad always told me that if anything, it was more important for women to get an education because they were sort of heads of the family and in a position to pass down knowledge to their children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a very famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad from 7th century Arabia where he says, pursue knowledge, even if you have to go all the way to China, you know, which in those days was a really, really long distance. So, and my dad always said, you know, it applies even more to you. It's your responsibility to be financially independent and educated. So I didn't even know that Islam was sexist until I got, you know, until I got older and I started working and people started telling me. So,
because that's what they're learning in the media and that there's a reason behind it. There's a reason behind using ideas like sexism or fear to justify the resource grabs that the United States government in particular is doing around the world, specifically in majority Muslim countries. Can you?
Yes. When we attacked Afghanistan, you remember probably Laura Bush saying that we were going to go save the Afghan women, right?
That's really challenging to think about because we don't realize the effects that war has on actually creating greater tension for women in society.
Yeah, exactly. And there's really a reluctance to separate all the factors. So when it comes to Muslim women, religion is one factor, of course, but there's also socioeconomics and culture mm-hmm. and, you know, wealth and lack of access to education, all those things that matter. And, of course, you know, again, in the U.S. media, what we see oftentimes is Muslim women abroad all covered up because those are the images that are, well, they're more different than we are. And so they're more, I don't know, titillating in some respect. And you know, it's just human nature to want to feel superior. You know, it's human nature to be confirmed in our own biases. And when we see people who are of a different culture who are not doing as well, then that confirms how we're so much better.
And
it's just human nature. It happens to all of us. But, you know, what I always wonder is that why are we comparing American non-Muslim women with Muslim women overseas? You know, if we really want to see what effect Islam has on women, well, why don't we compare American Muslim women with American non-Muslim women, right? Because that would be apples and apples. I mean, comparing non-Muslim women in America to Muslim women overseas is apples and oranges. So when you do look at American Muslim women in the United States, they're doing very well. They're the second most educated faith group, you know, second only to Jewish American women. American Muslims have the most parity in income, which means that men and women's incomes when it comes to American Muslims is nearly the same. So they're, you know, they're doing very well. So I think that's what we have to look at. Clearly, Islam is not what's being sexist if American Muslim women are doing so well.
I want to point out as well that there's been so much anti-Muslim rhetoric in the media, since the Bush administration, but also in the recent elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to point out that it's challenging because the rhetoric itself is violence. And people, I don't think, fully grasp that, oh, well, he's,
yes.
You know, this person or this administration, you know, has promised to make Muslims register and has said that that Syrian refugees are terrorists. And that is that in itself is violence in itself. And not to that anything that happens after that is violence as well. But we have to become aware that the rhetoric itself is violence. And
I know what you're saying. You know, it's interesting because when I was a kid, this was before the Iranian Revolution, and people hadn't really heard of Islam, but I also didn't encounter much hostility. I just encountered lack of information or sort of blank looks, you know? Mm. It wasn't until after the Iranian Revolution, which was most Americans' first impression of Islam, really. It was after the Iranian Revolution that I started to get more hostile reactions. And that increased. So really, it was the Iranian Revolution in 1979 that kind of changed the American landscape and the way American media treated conflict. So it's very interesting. A lot of conflicts, which used to be characterized as political, after 1979 started to get characterized as religious, because suddenly there was this new awareness of Islam out there. And then, of course, there was 9/11, which made things more difficult. But, you know, I think the problem is that the way that issues involving Muslims are framed. So when there's a Muslim criminal, the situation is always characterized as occurring because of Islam, because of the religion. Mm. You know, in Iraq, after the 2003 invasion, the country kind of disintegrated, and I noticed that all the reporting that was coming out was really characterizing the conflict as sectarian conflicts, you know, conflicts between Sunni and Shia, and not really making any difference between what might be a sectarian conflict, what might be an infrastructure war, what might be a resource war, what might be general, you know, criminal thuggery, which, you know, there was no separation of the causes of the conflicts that were taking place. It was just kind of lumped into this one category of, oh, they're fighting because they're Muslims and they are Sunni and Shia. So I think there's a real problem with how things are presented in this country. If you look at the statistics, you know, only 6% of domestic terrorism has been perpetrated by Muslims. In Muslim countries, murder rates are actually lower than in non-Muslim countries. Professor Stephen Fry did a study showing this. He's a professor at Berkeley. And, you know, even ISIS, which we hear about all the time, 80% of the victims of ISIS are other Muslims. They're not Americans. And yet there's this big fear in the U.S. about Muslim violence and Muslim terrorism. And I think a lot of it is just a real unfamiliarity with the actual statistics and the actual numbers. And the media, of course, never presents it in terms of statistics and numbers. The media just kind of presents it as this really scary thing always in front of our faces. So I have to tell you that the funniest statistic that I just read, it was Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and they said that Americans are 82 times more likely to be killed falling out of bed than in a terrorist attack.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that take warning, everybody, that this is there's greater fears out there than your Muslim neighbors. And I'm saying that tongue in cheek, because really there is nothing to fear of Muslims in America.
Yeah, I mean, criminals are criminals, and certainly there are Muslim criminals out there. I don't deny that. You know, there are people who are joining extremist groups, but the numbers are actually very small. So Charles Kurzman is a professor at the University of North Carolina, and he says in the last 25 years, fewer than 100,000 Muslims have been recruited to these extremist groups out of 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. So that's less than 1 out of 15,000, the 1/15,000th of the Muslim world, a very small number. So most Muslim, I mean, so not denying that there are Muslim criminals out there and that there are conflicts, but most of those have political motivations. So if you actually, when they do actually interview the terrorists themselves say, well, we have political grievances. We're not acting out of religious reasons. We're not acting because we want to convert other people. We're acting because we have political grievances. François Didier was he's a French journalist who was with ISIS for 10 months. And he told CNN that he said, there were not, you know, I never saw a Quran. We didn't talk about religion. We talked about politics. So, you know, that's what's going on. So I think there needs to be a recognition that these conflicts are political in nature. There are Muslims who do bad things, and but most Muslims are like any other group. The vast majority are just going about their business, you know, trying to make a living.
You know, we have just a few minutes before our mid-show break, and I'd like to have you on for a few minutes after that so we can talk a little bit more about the peace tradition in Islam before you jump off the interview. But before that, can you set us up a little bit for understanding some of the practices of Islam? As a Muslim, what are the beliefs that are part of the religion, and what's the expression of those beliefs in your experience? In just a few minutes.
So I suspect most middle school kids now learn about these. You know, there are five pillars of Islam. So really, in order to be a Muslim, all you have to do is believe that there's only one God and that Muhammad is his messenger. And then the things that you're supposed to do, which are kind of the pillars of the religion, are you have to give to charity, fast, pray five times a day, make a journey to Mecca in what is now, you know, Saudi Arabia, once in your lifetime, if you can afford it. So those are the five pillars. There's the declaration of faith, fasting, prayer, donation to charity, and pilgrimage to Mecca once in your lifetime, if you can. So, you know, jihad, which is something that comes up all the time, especially in the context of you know, the terrorists. I mean, the BBC now uses jihadist as interchangeable with terrorist, and that is something that just breaks my heart, because jihad, for one thing, is not a pillar of Islam. It's not even a word that I ever heard of until I got to high school. And what it really means is struggle. So jihad means struggle. There are two kinds of struggle. There's the internal struggle to make yourself a better person, and there's the external struggle to make society a better place. And in the external struggle, the external jihad, you can make society a better place in a number of ways. You can have jihad by the word, which is using words to make society better. Like, that means writing to your congressperson or writing letters to the editor. There's jihad by the hand, which is doing good works in order to make society better, such as volunteering for a soup kitchen, for example. And then finally, there's jihad by the sword, which is defined as taking up arms in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. So jihad is very limited. It's not just war when you feel like making war. It's war in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. And even if there's a legitimate jihad, there are many rules of engagement. So even if you're in a legitimate jihad, you may not kill civilians. You may not kill people taking refuge in holy places. You may not kill clergy. You may not kill children. You can't poison the water supply. You can't commit terrorism, which is defined as the clandestine use of force. You can't arbitrarily destroy property. You can't poison the water supply or commit suicide. So these are really narrow. I mean, these are, I would argue, are even narrower than our modern international rules of warfare. So obviously, if you look at these rules, ISIS, there's no way those people are committing jihad. I mean, they're just criminals. They're killing civilians. They're committing so many violations of Islam and Islamic law that that they're criminals. They're not jihadists.
So for those of you just tuning in, I'm talking with Sambal Ali Karamali, who is the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, and Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam. You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, and we're going to take a short break and come back with our guest and then with Shannon Radsky of the Nonviolent Peace Force. I just want to let you know where I'll be coming up at the next part of the show, and that'll be with Abdul Ghaffar Khan, because I think it'll be a really interesting segue between the nonviolent peace force and their work that had been influenced by the Shanti Sena and the Kudai Khidmatgar. So stay tuned, and thanks for joining me for the next part of the show, Sambal. This is Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and we have been talking with Sambal Ali Karamali, who's the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, and Growing Up Muslim, Understanding the Beliefs and Practices of Islam. And before the break, we were just on the topic of jihad, and there's two different kinds of jihad, an internal jihad and an external jihad. And Sambal, let's review that quickly in terms of, you said there's a jihad of patient forbearance, and that I know that in that patience is another word for nonviolence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So while the early, Islam was born in the 7th century in Arabia, and so while this kind of jihad doctrine was being developed, and again, there's the internal jihad to make yourself a better person, but while the military or taking up arms jihad was being developed by some Islamic scholars, other Islamic scholars were developing a jihad of patient forbearance. And they did this on the basis of two things. One is that there are more verses in the Quran about patient forbearance than there are about fighting. And the second thing is that they looked to the Prophet Muhammad's example. So when the Prophet Muhammad was, when he first started his prophethood, I guess you could call it, when he was 40, for 12 years, he never took up arms. He practiced nonviolent resistance against his persecutors, who were the powerful people in the city he lived in Mecca. So he and his followers were persecuted for 12 years, but they practiced nonviolent resistance by continuing to preach, both in secret and in public, by encouraging the followers to emigrate when things got too bad for them, and by buying slaves who had converted to Islam and setting them free. So that was how they practiced nonviolent resistance. And Muhammad also, he never started a war. All the fighting verses in the Quran have to do with an ongoing conflict with the Meccans. So the jihad of patient forbearance was developed based on these things, based on the Quran and based on the Prophet's example. And although, we hear a lot about people committing violence in the name of Islam, there have been countless instances of people using the Quran as a basis for nonviolence. Mm-hmm. So in the 1940s, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, whom you mentioned, also called Badshah Khan, was a Pashtun living in the northwest part of Pakistan, what's now Pakistan, near the sort of between the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And he was a Pashtun who are fierce warriors who were renowned for being very quick to offense and quick to, use weapons and quick to continue blood feuds. And yet he got 100,000 of his fellow Pashtuns to put down their weapons and march against the British in nonviolent resistance. And, the British regiments would fire on them and they would die, and more Pashtuns would come to take their place unarmed, and they never picked up arms. And Badshah Khan spread this idea of nonviolent resistance as a part of the jihad of patient forbearance, as based on the Quran. But there have been also other recent examples as well. So nonviolent resistance in Pakistan was responsible for overthrowing Musharraf, who was the military dictator there until recently. Also in the Maldives, nonviolent resistance and peaceful protests were responsible for ousting their dictator, who had been ruling for 30 years. And obviously, the Arab Spring started as nonviolent resistance against the dictatorships there. And in Tunisia and in Egypt, it stayed nonviolent. Tunisia is now a democracy, so it's really nice to see that one was successful. But there have been, you know, countless examples, and I think those need to be brought out, because I think every religion has a peace tradition, and Islam is no exception. Again, there are more verses in the Quran on peace and patient forbearance, and even the verses that do have to do with fighting in the Quran are always followed by a verse that says something like, but do not attack them unless they attack you first, mm-hmm. or do not be the aggressor, because God loves not the aggressors, mm. or, you know, or if they cease to fight, you must also cease to fight. So in the Quran, you know, those fighting verses are limited by these other verses that always follow.
And as you were pointing out as well, that people might say, well, you're just picking and choosing what you mm-hmm. want to hear. But you were pointing out, well, let's look at the Bible. Let's look at the Old Testament and pick and choose in there what we think is what sounds violent or nonviolent. And would people really stand by some of the violent statements in the Old Testament, for example?
Right. I think there can't be a double standard. You right. know, if we take historical context into mm-hmm. account, mm-hmm. When we're talking about Judaism and Christianity, then of course we have to take historical context into account when it comes to Islam, and also intertextual context, right? So we can't just take one verse and ignore all the other verses
right.
around it. It has to be taken as a whole. So, and also, you know, we have to recognize that the Quran was addressing certain situations that were happening in 7th century Arabia, but that doesn't mean that we have the same situation now and that the Quran has to be applied in the same way now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sambal Ali Karmali, thank you so much for joining me today on the interview.
Oh.
And I want to turn...
Thank you.
People can find out about your work at a website, MuslimNextDoor.com, right? That's, there's no the in front of it. Just Muslim Next, www.
Yes, that's right, MuslimNextDoor.com, yes.
And it would be very important for people to read your books and to listen to your talks and send you their questions if they have any questions, because combating Islamophobia in the United States is going to be a big job, and it's for all of us to participate in. So thank you.
Well, I have to just say, it's been a little scary. You know, this election rhetoric has been a little scary mm-hmm. For Muslims. But also, I blog for the Huffington Post. So if your listeners would like to read some of my pieces, they can always search for my name on the Huffington Post website.
And I hope to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
And I'm excited to shift to Shannon Radsky of the Nonviolent Peace Force, because with the information that you were just sharing with us, we're going to learn a little bit about some of the skills that we can use to intervene in conflicts when we see them, too. So,
oh, great. Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Welcome, Shannon, to Peace Paradigm Radio. It's great to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Hi, Stephanie. Thank you so much for having me. And I guess before diving in, I also wanted to say thank you to the author of The Muslim Next Door. I'm really so happy to hear that she was on the radio. It's such a crucially important topic that she's highlighting, and
yeah.
especially right now.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It was amazing to listen to.
Well, I'm glad that you both are on the show today, because I think that the pieces are really hang well together in terms of listening to a major issue facing us in this mm-hmm. In this time, and mm-hmm. then looking into the legacy of the peace tradition in Islam that was embodied by someone like Badshah Khan. And you are a part of the Nonviolent Peace Force, which is an organization that drew inspiration from Gandhi's peace army idea, Shanti mm-hmm. Sena, that was led by Narayan Desai, to Badshah Khan's work as well. So tell us a little bit about the Nonviolent Peace Force, first of all, and then you can give us a bit of an update about where you've just been. You've been actually working in the U.S., so tell us.
Yeah, okay. So I guess just to start, Nonviolent Peace Force, it's an international non-governmental organization. We practice what's called unarmed civilian protection. And what that looks like varies quite a lot from context to context. In many ways, it's sort of about the practical application of nonviolent and peaceful strategies. But at the heart of it as well, it's about understanding how conflict affects communities and how we can work together to protect civilians, especially that are affected by violent conflict. I'm from the U.S. I got back to the U.S. in mid-September. Before that, I had been living for 2 years in South Sudan, working with Nonviolent Peace Force as an international protection officer and then as a team leader, living in, you know, both deep field, in camp settings, in the capital, Juba, working on a variety of the methodologies that, and practices that we use on the ground. When I got back in September, Nonviolent Peace Force in the U.S., which has an office based in St. Paul in Minnesota, was thinking about, well, obviously concerned and thinking about Standing Rock. So as soon as I was back on the ground, considering we don't have very many active field staff in the U.S., there are a number of people from the U.S. that work with NP in the different field offices, but because we don't have very many people on the ground here in the U.S., as soon as I got back, it was then a discussion of how can we get out to North Dakota to understand what's happening, because sort of a fundamental thing about Nonviolent Peace Force, which I drew me to the organization and which I continue to love, is that it's not about necessarily the imposition of certain tactics and certain strategies. It's actually about taking the time to sit with communities and understand how conflict is affecting them and collaborating directly with communities on making their environment safer and more secure and also building peace. So do you want me to just describe, I guess, what Standing Rock looked like, or what would be the best?
Thanks for asking. So, Shannon Radsky of the Nonviolent Peace Force, you got back from South Sudan, where you were working as a team leader for the Nonviolent Peace Force, which is a group that does unarmed civilian protection. And the U.S. office of the Nonviolent Peace Force was starting to look at the conflict that's taking place with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it seems like a new development for the Nonviolent Peace Force and for this work in general. That's amazing that the organization is expanding in that way to not only look at conflict at other parts of the world, but really to say that we can do something about conflict in the U.S., even though there are domestic peace teams that work here, like the META peace team is a good example. So, but you took all of your skills and you were invited, I imagine, to Standing Rock. You found, what did you have to do in order to go there and what happened?
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, first thing, just to clarify, I have a teammate and I, we went together, the two of us, and it was very much an exploration or an assessment or a learning experience rather than a full-on practicing a lot of the skills that we use on the ground in other parts of the world because the environment is new, it's dynamic, and it's something that we haven't quite stepped into in other places. The U.S. office, but also ourselves, felt it extremely important to understand the context on the ground. So my teammate, who was a colleague that I've worked with in South Sudan, he joined me in St. Paul. And we spent a few days first in St. Paul trying to make connections with people that had been on the ground inside the camps in Standing Rock, but also in Bismarck and in other places, including Iowa, because even Standing Rock is sort of middle of the media attention right now, it's also important to recognize that there were similar demonstrations taking place in Lee County, Iowa, on the Mississippi, what was called sort of Mississippi Stand. So we had contacts that had been out at the Standing Rock camps over the course of the last couple of months, because it's also important to bear in mind that the camps on the reservation and on the land for the Army Corps of Engineers, they've been there since April. This is not something that just started, you know, in the last month or just started in the last 2 months. So we had contacts and friends of NP that had been out there, had been at the camp, and they were the ones that sort of raised the flag to red flag or attention to us and said, you know what, it's worth coming out and seeing with your eyes what's going on and seeing if there's a way that NP can work on the ground, can work with the unarmed civilian protection on the ground. So my colleague and I prepared. Mid-October, we headed out. We drove from St. Paul to Bismarck first. We attempted to connect with local authorities, with the National Guard, with the governor's office, with the Public Service Commission, a number of people in Bismarck. Because also something that's really important to bear in mind is that Nonviolent Peace Force is a nonpartisan organization because we believe, well, it's in order to work inside of conflicts that are super dynamic, we need to be able to work with all actors that are a part of a conflict because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, all actors must come together to solve violent conflict. And it's building relationships with everyone that's party to the situation grants us the space and the ability to dialogue and to collaborate and to learn and to work together. So for us, we wanted to start in Bismarck first. We wanted to try to hear all sides of what's going on. We wanted to hear from local community members in Bismarck, from ranchers, and we endeavored to do so. Unfortunately, it wasn't very easy to connect with the Sheriff Department of Morton County or the National Guard as much as we were running around. So we didn't get as much one-on-one time as we would have liked. But we did speak with members of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and with the Public Service Commission in Bismarck. Then we went to Standing Rock itself. We decided to stay in the Osheti Shekoan camp, which is the camp on the public, well, it's on the area that's currently disputed, right? It's the land that is that the Army Corps of Engineers has seemingly jurisdiction over. Mm-hmm. And it is on the opposite side of the Cannonball River stream that sort of separates the Safe Stone camp and the Osheti Shekoan camp. And we went there because... Oh.
Yes.
Hello, can you hear me? Okay, sorry.
Sounds like there's some kind of an announcement.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Really.
We're focusing in on what you're saying. You have our attention.
Okay. So I think I might call back. Is that okay?
You can. I think the call is just fine. If you can continue, that would be ideal.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we decided to stay in the Osheti Shekoan camp because we wanted to see as many people in the different camps that had been established out there as we could.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt it was a good environment to speak with elders, to speak with community members, to speak with Native allies from other parts of the U.S. as well as non-Native allies that were coming. And I mean, Stephanie, I hope I can adequately describe what we saw. It was both magnificent, chaotic, confusing, mm-hmm. but
And you're coming from a conflict. You're coming from a civil war in South Sudan,
yeah,
and you're saying this about right. what's taking place in North Dakota. So,
yeah.
What are some? Let's talk about some of the skills that you have been trained in. That maybe so you're doing assessment. That's important for anybody who wants to mm-hmm. do peacemaking, right?
Yeah.
Is to nonpartisan mm-hmm. assessment of what's taking place. Say more about that.
Okay, so I think something that's also really important to understand is that, you know, in working in peace building and conflict resolution and protection, we are at an advantage because we're not providing material aid. In fact, you know, our asset is time
mm-hmm.
and is listening.
Mm-hmm.
And before we step in anywhere, even in the process of stepping into communities, we spend an enormous amount of time just sitting with people and listening. And that was the objective of this exploration as well. We went into the camps in Standing Rock not with the agenda to start imposing our ideas on how, you know, whether it's coordination between camps or dialogue between certain actors or capacity building in nonviolent language and conflict resolution and protection mechanisms. No, that was not the agenda. what we wanted to do was literally just to go and to listen and to learn. And that is what we said to everyone that we met. We didn't go in saying, you know, with high visibility, wearing our nonviolent Peace Force uniform, saying, you know, we are here, we do UCP, and we want to help. We want to make sure everything goes well. It was, we're here. We sought advice from elders. We sat around the sacred fire repeatedly. We listened to members of the different small camps inside of Ocheti Chacoan. We spoke to neighbors. We spoke to elders from, you know, tribes that comprise the Lakota. We also spoke with Native allies from Utah to the East Coast. And we sat in something that was found really remarkable and helpful for us was a community meeting. There are daily community meetings being held and facilitated by a community member himself. And every day at 10 a.m., we met in this communal tent. And it was facilitated through sort of a traditional Lakota community style, which was everyone sits in a gigantic circle and you go around clockwise listening to anyone that has an opinion or something to say or an ask. And then, you know, going around and around and around until you could complete one round of the circular meeting without anyone having additional comments. And sometimes the meetings lasted an hour and a half. Sometimes they lasted 3 hours or more because it was, we found it to be sort of the most, functional and positive, space, on a daily basis that allowed for a forum for, you know, dialogue, creativity, you know, nonviolent communication. It was a really astonishing thing to observe. And we learned so much there. I mean, we met so many different community members there. Mm-hmm. And then after a few days in the camp, we then went to South Dakota to meet with additional contacts, whether they were members of grassroots organizations in South Dakota, academics, and members of the clergy that also had, you know, their own insights or ideas or knowledge of what was going on. So we did that to try to, one, take a step back from the camp because, again, in order to maintain sort of a nonpartisan and comprehensive view of what's going on, we didn't want to just fully kind of ingratiate or be in the camp all the time because there is also a very clear energy and tension and perspective coming from the camp, which, you know, is founded in a lot of a very important things, whether it's, you know, climate change and preservation of the water, or whether it's respect for Native tribes, or whether it's, you know, the generational trauma, PTSD, and violations that have been committed against these groups. These types of tensions and things are palpable. And so we wanted to take a step back because we had to remember, all right, we are here on an exploration, which means we have to also understand what is the perspective of the police officers of Morton County, of the highway patrol, of the police officers coming from different states, of the National Guard, of the governor's office. What are those perspectives? Yeah. And how does this all play together?
Well, Shannon Radsky, you're with the Nonviolent Peace Force, and you have so much experience in unarmed civilian protection work, and you are breaking new you are part of a team that's breaking new ground of exploring projects within the United States. And how can people? We'd love to have you back on the show another time. We're going to need to wrap up now.
No problem.
How can people learn more about the Nonviolent Peace Force? Because this is a huge constructive action that anybody with the heart for it can support in some way, shape, or form. Going to the website, which is nonviolentpeaceforce.org, right?
Mm-hmm. And yes, absolutely, please, yeah.
Okay, Shannon.
And also, okay, so let me. I guess a pitch for NPP because I deeply
love 30 seconds.
So definitely the website nonviolentpeaceforce.org. Look at the Facebook page, Nonviolent Peace Force on the Facebook page. we're trying to get better at social media. We're trying to capture more stories from on the ground. So those are definitely the two best vehicles to do so. Facebook is updated routinely, I think pretty regularly.
Yep.
But explore the website. We're putting more and Beautiful. More of our institutional knowledge on there.
Thank you so much, Shannon Radsky of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Everybody, you've been listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. Until the next time, take care of one another, and I mean it.